The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now, you're multitasking. But what if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. So multitask right now. Get your quote now at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Ultimately, I mean, it doesn't really matter what round you take the player in. Once he walks in the door, he's a New England Patriot player, and he puts on the uniform and goes out there and competes. It doesn't matter if he's in the second round or the fifth round. That doesn't matter once he's on your team.
Friday edition, Pro Football Talk Live, April 16, 2021. Also happens to be Bill Belichick's birthday. Happy birthday, Coach, 69 years old. Peter King here today. Mike Florio, 2 hours, and off we go. You know, Peter, yesterday on PFTPM, we started with a little clip from Belichick, and he smiled. I did the double take. If I'd have had water in my mouth, I would have done the classic spit take. Bill Belichick smiled. He seemed a little looser yesterday. He seemed a little more friendly, a little more gregarious, although he's set the bar very low over the years. I was happy to see it. It's refreshing to see Bill Belichick that way. Maybe he's realizing now that he's on the brink of 70, life's too short to be miserable and guarded all the time.
I wouldn't count on it, Mike. Look, I think one of the great things about being away from the public part of your job for 4 months, basically. 3 months, I should say. Being away from the public part of your job for that length of time, you get to basically say, hey, look, I've had a big break. Okay, we're back into it. The draft is here. And so Edelman retired. I think he had a lot of kind of happiness / goodwill stored up. And, to me, I think Bill is very good at the sort of thoughtful and pensive parts of the job. He's very bad at the dissecting a loss at the end of a game when something bad happened. I don't think the latter is ever going to change. But you're right. It was good to see him, kind of almost bright and cheerful yesterday.
Here's hoping he didn't completely empty the tank of goodwill yesterday and that maybe we'll see some more of it from time to time. But it really was refreshing to see. And the guy is one of the great coaches of all time. And who knows how much longer he will keep going. Robert Kraft told us at the league meetings 4 years ago he'd like to see Bill Belichick coach into his 80s. I know at one point Belichick said he can't imagine coaching at 70. Different feeling when you're a year away from 70. He's shown no sign of slowing down. And I think now he's rejuvenated by what they've done in the offseason as they try to rebuild and have another chapter of this run of greatness the Patriots have had. That's one of the things that compels me the most this offseason, Peter. Are we on the brink of a new era where the Patriots are dominant, or are they going to continue to struggle like we saw last year? This is so foreign to our experience in the past two decades. It's inherently fascinating to watch how it all plays out.
Look, I think that's one of the reasons why this draft is so important for New England. You know, how does this draft play out? Is there going to be a quarterback that Bill Belichick likes around, let's say, 8, 9, 10? You know, are you going to see Bill Belichick or his dog Nike pick up the phone and call Carolina at 8, Denver at 9, or Dallas at 10 and try to move up and get, pick one, Trey Lance, Mac Jones, Justin Fields? What are you going to see as this draft goes on? Because, Mike, look, you know, Bill Belichick, once in his career, if you look back at the, you know, the drafts he's been involved with in Cleveland and New England, you know, Tom Brady is the ultimate outlier. The 199th pick in the sixth round of the 2000 draft, that only happens once. You can't count on Jimmy Garoppolo and Jared Stidham and all that. You know, you can't count on that. So if you see a quarterback, and Josh McDaniels and he have been to most or all of the workouts, you know, if you see a quarterback you like, you got to work hard to go up and get him. I am convinced that if Baker Mayfield had fallen some, you know, in the draft 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, that the Patriots would have made a play and tried to go get him, but he would have had to fall, obviously, well past number one. And I think this is the year, being at number 15, where they're in position that they could go get a quarterback if one falls around 8, 9. And look, this is one sad list of quarterbacks. And of course, you see, when in Bill Belichick's time, this will be his 22nd draft in New England, and he's never used a first-round pick on a quarterback. I think if one of them falls to around 8, 9, 10, I think the Patriots need to move aggressively, dangle their first-round pick in 2022 to try to go up and get it.
And that really is the key, being at a starting point of 15 where it isn't quite as far to move to get into that striking distance if there's a guy you really like that slips through. Let's hear Belichick himself from yesterday. Some of that goodwill that made its way into his assessment of what the Patriots' options are as they hold the 15th overall selection in the 2021 draft.
I think that it, again, each draft's a little bit different, and so each year is a little bit different. But all that being said, you know, at 15, I think we could eliminate a few players that won't be at 15. And then you could look at a couple scenarios and say, well, if, you know, these three players are there, which one would we take? If these other three different players were there, which one would you take? You know, you go through that exercise and talk about that. But I would say normally something, now there's less options at 15 than there are at, you know, 28, 30, 31, you know, some other spots that we drafted from. But I would say normally something will happen and there could very well be a player there that either you don't expect to be there or maybe he is a couple spots, maybe at 12, 13, he's still on the board and you really thought that he'd be gone in the top 6, 7 picks. And then that, and, you know, then the question comes, you know, do you move up and try to get that player that's fallen a little bit?
You know, it occurred to me yesterday when we played that sound on PFTPM that if you took that transcript and gave it to Frank Caliendo and said, read this like John Madden, it would work because there was a lot of obvious there. And I could see that whole rhythm and pattern fitting Coach Madden's way of explaining things. But he's right. He's right. They're at 15. They're rarely at 15. They're starting in a spot that allows them to get into the top 10 if that guy they like busts through. And part of the challenge here is you're going to have teams in the top 10 that are tempted to overdraft quarterbacks, reach for quarterbacks, go earlier than they should in the hopes of getting lucky and finding a franchise guy. That's part of the philosophy that they're competing with as they apply that more strategic aspect to it. And, Peter, we saw them break from character in free agency. Maybe they do break from character. Maybe they do have an element of roll the dice. They want their franchise guy. They're willing to take their chance. We're going to be at 15, ideally, once every 40 years. Let's take advantage of that spot. Let's move up. If it works, great. If it doesn't, we'll find another way.
I think the other part of this that's going to be really interesting, Mike, is how aggressive are teams down in the round, as well as how aggressive will the Patriots be? Because right below them at 19, you've got Washington. At 20, you've got Chicago. Both of those teams, I think Chicago's probably less likely, you know, to pillage future drafts to move up for a quarterback. But I'm not so sure about Washington. I think Washington is sort of laying there in the weeds. When you look at pick number 19 right now, you know, how much is Washington willing to affect future drafts if a quarterback that they like a lot is going to be there around, excuse me, around 11, 12, 13? Could they move up? Could they leapfrog New England? And you know what, Mike? The one other thing about New England is they do the best job, in my opinion, of any team in the NFL of hiding their intentions before the draft. So I'm not going to know. You're not going to know. We're just, you know, we're going to have to wait until they open the gifts on Christmas Day in 13 days.
Yeah, Chris Sims has explained in the past that when he worked there, how the circle of people who actually knew what Belichick's board was extremely small, and they kept that information away from anyone else in the building. People who otherwise would be trusted, not trusted with that information. A little extra pressure in the building this year by virtue of comments that were made a couple of weeks back from owner Robert Kraft. Candid, biting criticism of the team's recent experiences in the draft, inability to draft, inability to develop as well. I think that's part of it we need to keep in mind. Here's Bill Belichick talking about the struggles that the Patriots have had on draft day in recent years.
Well, we're always, you know, always looking to do to get better. Always try to evaluate everything we do and try to find a better way to do it. So that's a, I would say, an annual process with the draft, but it's something that we do on a regular basis throughout the course of the season, whether it's, you know, whatever period of time it is. So, you know, always looking to do a better job. There were some things that last year that were unique to the draft process. As I mentioned, some of those are similar this year. Some of them are a little bit different. So we, you know, certainly use some of that experience to improve the process a little bit this year. At least we felt we improved it this year. Yeah, but ultimately, we're still going to try to, you know, evaluate the players and make the decisions that we feel like are best for the football team.
The departure of Nick Caserio, the VP of player personnel since 2009, forced some of those changes, but also the first-round picks the team has exercised in recent years, getting them to take a closer look at what they're doing, how they're doing it. There was a report from Albert Breer a couple of weeks ago that Bill Belichick went off the board to take N'Keal Harry at receiver in the first round 2 years ago when A.J. Brown and Deebo Samuel were more highly rated by the team's scouts. And Peter, the other angle of this that fascinates me, Belichick talked about how Matt Patricia, the former Lions coach, who before that was a longtime assistant coach in New England, is heavily involved in the draft. And as of a couple of weeks ago, there were reports that Patricia was negotiating free agent contracts, signing his name to the deals like the Cam Newton contract. Patricia's becoming like another version of Ernie Adams, where we're not really quite sure what he does, but he's doing a lot of things to support the cause in New England.
When Matt Patricia interviewed for a job with the Rams a few years ago, I forget, I think it was the year that they hired I think it was the year that they hired Sean McVay. In their round of interviews that year, Patricia was interviewed by the Rams, and the Rams walked away. And I remember thinking this at the time, what an odd kind of conclusion. But the Rams walked away and said, Matt Patricia would be a really good general manager. He sees the entire organization, you know, and a lot of their conversation that day was about that. And Mike, I want to go back on one of the things that you said, you know, before Belichick's last bite, and that is this. I will never forget covering the draft 10 years ago. I was not in Foxborough, or, you know, I wasn't around the Patriots, but I do remember one very specific story about that draft. That was a draft they took Nate Solder in the first round. And in the second round, they had a high second round pick, and they chose a cornerback, an oft-injured cornerback from Virginia named Ross I. Dowling. And when that pick was made, a lot of the team scouts, you know, who are, as you say, in New England, it is a need-to-know basis organization. You know, those guys do not know what Bill Belichick's board says. And jaws hit the floor when they picked Ross I. Dowling, because the scouts were positive that year they were going to take a pass rusher like Jabal Sheard or Brooks Reed. And when they heard that pick, they had no idea whatsoever that Ross I. Dowling was even in play, you know, to get picked. And so that's why, you know, it's somebody, for people who say, man, if you have good sources inside the Patriots, this is the year you got to use them. I don't think it matters. There's only one source inside the Patriots, you know, and he's not going to talk before the draft. So, you know, at least talk openly, honestly. So I do think this is really one of the mystery teams going into the draft, as it is every year.
And Peter, it reminds me of the story from a couple of years ago when Mike Mayock was the GM of the Raiders for his first draft. And it was a big deal for a news cycle or two that they sent everyone else home the week before the draft. And Sims and I concluded that was motivated in large part by the fact that John Gruden can't keep his mouth shut in the building and feels compelled to go around office to office talking coach to coach and scout to scout to make sure that they agree with how he sees things. Belichick doesn't need that. He's got so much conviction in what he believes, and maybe to a fault. Maybe he would benefit from getting the perspective of others. He just doesn't trust them, so he doesn't share it. And that could lead to some of these decisions like in Keel Harry, where he really didn't talk it through with anyone because he didn't want anyone to know what he was thinking.
Look, there's a long line of decisions that have been made over the years by people who don't want anybody else to know. The year that Mike Shanahan chose Jay Cutler in the draft, nobody in his organization knew until 11 o'clock that morning. And I mean nobody, not even ownership. And so that's how you keep a secret. You talk about Mike Mayock in that particular draft, you're absolutely right, Mike. You know, he didn't want anybody in the organization knowing what they were going to do and calling their buddies on other teams. But I also think there was another reason, too, that by that time, Mike Mayock had determined that there were X number of scouts and some people who probably weren't going to be around very long, you know, with the Raiders, either for whatever reason. He had somebody else he thought could do a better job. Maybe these guys had gotten used to cutting corners with the Raiders over the years. Who knows? But I do recall that very specifically, and I really remember, because I was in Oakland after the first round of that draft and had a long conversation with Mayock. Mayock was very convinced that this organization had to get the ability to keep secrets. And so I think you and Chris were right in what you thought.
Of course, maybe they should have let the word out that they were looking at Cleveland Farrell as the fourth overall pick a couple years ago and let somebody else leapfrog them to get him. I'm only partially serious about that. Serious the Patriots were when it came to spending in free agency. We mentioned that earlier. One more clip from Bill Belichick yesterday talking about that process of going all in like never before. Here's the question he was asked and how he went about answering it.
The way you spent on offense, is that an indication that you feel like what you surrounded Cam with last year wasn't enough to highlight what Cam brought to the table?
Well, again, the process this offseason was to, as it always is, to try and improve the team and to try to do everything we can to make ourselves as competitive as we can this year, which is what we try to do every year. So, you know, we had several years in free agency where we were, you know, one of the least cash-spending teams in the league, and then this year, that changed and balanced it off. And so that's really what you have in the NFL. Teams that don't spend, then spend. Teams that spend, then there are years when they don't spend. So it averages out over a period of time, and that's, you know, that's part of the averaging process came this year. But ultimately, we're trying to, again, do what we can to improve the team like we always do every year, and that's what we're going to continue to do as we work through the draft process and other team-building opportunities that may or may not come along during the season, but I'm sure there'll be others somewhere along the line, and we'll evaluate those when they present themselves.
Peter, he talks about the averaging process. What's the most intriguing about this? They've never been part of the averaging process on the spend side. Robert Kraft told you a few weeks back, those were the teams they made fun of in the past, the teams that went out and spent, knowing that they were overpaying for guys who were not going to deliver that championship that teams delude themselves into thinking they're going to buy in free agency. But this year they had to do it because the cupboard was otherwise too bare from a talent standpoint. And they had the cash and the cap space because of what happened with the pandemic, driving the salary cap down. Patriots were in a spot where need and opportunity came together, and we saw them do something we've never seen them do.
Look, the thing about the Patriots that has been unique over the years is that Tom Brady has been able to be a deodorant to hide a lot of faults on this team. And they don't have that deodorant anymore. They don't have that guy who's going to be able to win when your talent is down some. So now, obviously, after last year when they had, in my opinion, the worst collection of skill players of all 32 teams in the NFL, they woke up and they basically said, okay, let's go out and spend $96 million guaranteed or whatever the guaranteed number is incredible. And let's go spend, I think, $175 million on signing bonuses, you know, and all that. I just think, Mike, that Bill Belichick, you know, understands now that you're not going to be able to win unless you have some significant weaponry on your offense. You've got to get to the NFL in 2021. And the last couple of years, you saw it starting with Brady late in the 19 season. And in that playoff loss to Tennessee, they were awful at the skill positions. And now what you're seeing, especially, you know, exclamation point, the retirement of Julian Edelman. He can't save them now either. So, you know, it's time to get with the program and get with 2021 football and get enough weapons to really help your quarterback. Now we're going to see, is Cam Newton any good? He wasn't last year. What was the reason? Weaponry, COVID, we don't know, but he wasn't good last year. So now we're going to get to see if Cam Newton can be salvaged with a bunch of good weapons around him.
Edelman, one of the rare successes from the standpoint of drafting and developing. And I think the developing part of it doesn't get mentioned enough, Peter, because it's not like they are selecting players who are otherwise not on anyone else's board. These guys that they're picking would have been picked by someone else at some point. It's picking the guy maybe at the wrong spot, but then when he's in the building, it's not developing him. I'd love to know the story behind that. Does Belichick get too impatient with young guys? They make too many mistakes. I'd rather just have the veteran here. We don't trust the young guy. He never has that breakthrough moment, but they just don't develop the young skill position guys either. And that's one of the reasons Edelman stands out so clearly, because they developed the hell out of Julian Edelman, a college quarterback who converted to receiver and became a Super Bowl MVP.
You know, I'm going to write something in my column Monday about, you know, sort of the, you know, the genius of Julian Edelman and how Julian Edelman happened in the first place. Mike, did you know that when I was talking to him after he won the MVP, two years ago, after he won the MVP in the Super Bowl, he told me that, you know, had the football thing not worked out. I mean, first of all, his head coach at Kent State wanted him to go to Canada to play football in Canada and compete for a job as a quarterback in Canada. And he basically said, hey, listen, I want to be a pro football player, but I want to play in the NFL. I never dreamed of playing in the CFL. Not that there's anything wrong with the CFL, but I want to try to make the NFL. And of all the teams that worked him out that year, it was really, really interesting because he was worked out as a safety, as a nickel, and also as a return man, you know, as well as a receiver. And that year, that offseason, he worked with Charlie Fry, who was then a quarterback on the Cleveland Browns. He worked with Charlie Fry learning the receiver position. But you talk about, you know, how he was helped on that team. And here's what I'm told. When he got there, basically, Tom Brady, when you get to the Patriots, you've been drafted by the Patriots, or, you know, you're on the team, Brady will basically start working with you until he senses that you're not working hard, and you're not going to be a guy who I'm going to be able to rely on. But when that happened with Julian Edelman, that was the key to him, because Tom Brady saw how hard this guy worked, and he would stay after and after and after. And, you know, and so those are the reasons why guys succeed, in my opinion, in New England. You're going to get a chance. And as a receiver, you're going to get a chance. But when the guy who basically is in charge of determining, honestly, whether you're going to make it or not, if he sees the desire, the drive, the work ethic, he's going to beat you into the ground to make it work with you. Same thing happened when Chris Hogan went there as a free agent. So those are the kind of things that happened in New England. Now, you know, we'll see what happens with the tight ends this year with Cam Newton and how much they're able to work together. And a lot of it too, Mike, is what are they going to be allowed to do in this offseason? And I think that's going to be really important. In New England, those guys used to get together all the time anyway. And now, if they have organized workouts or whatever it is, they're going to have to find a way to get together this offseason.
We're going to be talking about that in the next segment. Before we take our break, though, you mentioned Julian Edelman experimenting at the nickel corner position. I still remember clearly him playing the slot against the Ravens in a playoff game once upon a time and covering Anquan Boldin, or more accurately, trying to cover Anquan Boldin. Edelman picked the right position ultimately to play other than quarterback in the NFL because it wasn't working at defensive back. Even though he took 27 snaps out of 73 in that AFC championship game that the Patriots ultimately won over the Ravens to cap the 2011 season. All right, Peter mentioned this offseason issue between the NFL and the NFLPA. What will happen? How will it resolve? And why? After achieving peace last year in two different aspects, new CBA, pandemic protocols, now they're fighting. We'll try to get to the bottom of it and figure out where it goes from here when PFT Live continues right after this.
Around any corner, within every battle, and with the dawn of each new day, the threat of the unexpected, the unpredictable, and the unrelenting lies in wait. but Marines will always be there. They are the constant in the chaos. No matter the battlefield, Marines adapt to win, defeating every shifting threat, protecting our nation's future. The few, the proud, the Marines.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A growing number of teams have issued statements indicating that due to pandemic-related concerns, they will exercise their prerogative to not participate in on-field workouts in 2021. This has been an issue that's lingered for a while. J.C. Treader, the president of the union, wants to get rid of the on-field off-season workouts altogether. The number of teams now up to 10. That means 22 have yet to speak. I wonder how many of those teams have decided, man, we're good. We're going to show up for the voluntary offseason program. Because, look, Peter, I don't think the union really knows what the reason is. I think there are multiple different reasons for it, and we're going to talk about that. But the bottom line is players are going to work out somewhere. They're not going to sit home and do nothing. They're going to try to get ready for training camp. The question is, are they going to work out at the team facility and be protected against any injury they may suffer? Are they going to stay home and ride the exercise bike and do push-ups and put in the old P90X DVDs? If you get injured there, you're not covered. They're going to go to Planet Fitness and lift weights there, drop a weight on your foot, bust your toe, you're not covered. Go to the local high school field, step on a rock, pop an Achilles, you're not covered. I hope the union is explaining to these guys the risk they're taking if they exercise anywhere other than in the team facility. You're putting your entire salary on the line for 2021 if you do that. So unless you're going to sit home, and I'll say this to all the players out there, all three of them that may be watching, and I'd take the under, to understand the risk you're taking if you are exercising anywhere but the team facility. And that's one of the reasons why I think as players understand this, Peter, look, it's admirable to take a stand. I support the union generally. I just think this isn't it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, Mike. This is a very interesting little conflict. And you could tell last fall when J.C. Treader began to talk about how we need to totally remake the offseason in the NFL. You know, this has been a fantastic season for, you know, health and well-being of players. So the way I look at this is, this is a little bit of the union flexing its muscles and saying to the NFL, look, these workouts are voluntary. And so we're not going to come if we don't want to come. And there's absolutely nothing you can do about this. I think one of the key things about this and why it is such an interesting time in the union and in the relationship between players and management in the NFL is, Mike, think about this, okay? 1,019 players voted to approve the new collective bargaining agreement that included the 17th game. 969 players voted against it. That, on average, is 2 players per locker room. That was the margin. You know, 60 votes is the margin. So you've got a tremendous number of players on both sides. And you know what I think of whenever I see each one of these statements from teams? I think of those 969 players. I think of Alvin Kamara. I think of the ticked off guys at the 17th game. And I think, hey, listen, we're going to show up and we're going to play. And we're going to be there 47 days before the start of the season for opening a training camp. Beyond that, we're not doing anything that we don't have to do.
I love that in theory, Peter, and I think there's so much imbalance in the relationship anyway between the league and the union, because the league will use the nuclear option of lost games to a work stoppage, whether it's a lockout or a strike, or if it's a strike, they'll just use replacement players and keep going. The players won't, as we learned in 1987, hold together in the face of a work stoppage that takes away game checks. I just think there's a huge disconnect between the collective desire to give the owners a middle finger and the individual issues that are going to arise. J.C. Treader made the comment earlier this week to Rich Eisen that the notion, as articulated by Bruce Arians, that this is just a matter of veterans not wanting younger players to get an opportunity to show that they can take roster spots. Treader called that an effort to divide the union. No, it's not. It's a recognition of the inherent divisions. This is a unique workforce. You got 90 guys per team now, ultimately 90 once they add the draft picks and the undrafted free agents. It's going to whittle down to 53. 37 guys are going to be gone. Now, some of them will be on the practice squad, but they're not getting the full game checks. They're competing for those spots. So at some point, Peter, the individual impetus to be one of the 53 is going to win out. You're going to have young players particularly who understand there's an opportunity here. And if the other players are upset with me, I don't care. The coach is happy with me, and he's the one who decides whether or not I'm on the team, not these other guys who are mad at me, and some of them may end up getting cut anyway because they're not here. That's the problem that this entire approach is inviting. So, again, I firmly believe, I love it. I love to see the union flexing its muscles. The problem is they're going to throw out a lumbar disc in the process, because it's going to expose and yet again reinforce the idea that collective action by this union can't work because there's too many guys whose best interests are going to be get your ass into the building and show up. I mean, Peter, plain and simple, once you understand, because these guys are not going to sit on the couch and watch TV. They're going to work out. Once they understand that if they get injured away from the facility, they don't get paid this season. If they get injured in the facility, it's basically free insurance against that fluke injury that may happen. I think once they understand that, this isn't going to hold together.
Mike, you talk about the 37 guys per team who are going to be gone. It really isn't that, because practice squads this year are going to be somewhere between 14 and 16.
They don't get paid. They don't get paid the same.
Right. I understand they don't get paid the same, but what I'm talking about is they still are allowed to vote and they still are allowed to express their opinions, you know, in terms of, you know, what their team is going to do. So the only point I'm making in this about this is that there is a gigantic middle and lower class in the National Football League that, in my opinion, hugely influenced the vote for the last CBA. And Mike, if that vote doesn't pass, I believe right now, there's no way you have the $113 billion media agreements that they signed last month. Absolutely no way. And you know what else they don't have? They don't have labor peace. They would not have gotten a deal done. And so right now, I believe you would be either in a lockout or on the verge of a lockout. And this season would be in total disarray. And I think all that is because the middle and lower class players basically stampeded to the ballot box and won this election, you know, for a new CBA, you know, much to D. Smith's pleasure. And so right now, I think you're seeing the results of that, because I just think there's a lot of big players and big time players who are still ticked off over that and who say, we're not giving the NFL any cooperation on this. And I see your point. You have a really good point about if they get hurt working out somewhere, you know, they're screwed. But I still think that the first reaction is going to be, we're not helping management at all.
Oh, and I agree with you there. And as this settles in, that's when it begins to crumble. You know, Peter, the way that the NFL has set up the offseason schedule this year is conducive to undermining the resolve of the veteran players, because phase two of the offseason program, May 17, that week, it also consists of the rookie minicamps. And that comes before there's ever an opportunity for the players to not show up for on-field work in phase three. That comes the next week. So before the players can ever truly flex their muscles and have an empty locker room on the day that they're going to practice for the first time in the offseason, before that occurs, you'll have the draft picks, you'll have the undrafted free agents, you'll have all the tryout participants, and there will be many of them at the rookie minicamp. There's 40, 50 guys that show up for this rookie minicamp. That's going to happen in 32 teams before we ever get to the point where the veterans don't show up. And you know what's going to happen? We're going to see all this footage of practice, and we're going to have quotes from coaches. And the average person who's paying minimal attention to this is going to be thinking, well, I thought, well, there went that NFLPA boycott thing. There's all these guys practicing. I mean, it's going to undermine the resolve of the veterans before we even get to day one of this legitimate and permissible boycott of voluntary offseason workouts. And who's going to be there for phase three, for the start of the traditional on-field workouts? It's going to be the undrafted free agents, most of the draft picks, and whoever happens to get a job via the tryout portion of the rookie minicamp. They're going to be there. So while the veterans are home, either doing nothing or risking their salaries by working out at Planet Fitness, product placement for no reason whatsoever, the young guys are going to be there getting the reps, currying favor with the coaching staff, and it's not going to take long. Just like it reminds me of the 87 strike, and the scabs from 87 are the undrafted players and the rookies in 2021. After a week or two of that, at most, the veterans are going to come back, because they're going to realize the train's going to keep rolling without them, and they're making it even harder for themselves to make the 53-man roster if all these young guys are there getting the first team reps.
Mike, let me ask you a question. Suppose that the union went to management right now and said, you know, as of right now, you know, a new coach in this season, right? A new coach could have had his players in-house. I think the date was April 6th. It was somewhere right around there. And then it was pushed back 2 weeks, right? But why don't players and management, why isn't there a compromise where you say no player in any facility, pick a date in May, no player goes to any facility until, let's say, May 10th, okay? So it gives the players, in essence, another month where they're basically free of any obligations. So to me, that might be a compromise if I am a veteran player that I would appreciate even more. But what are the pros and cons of that in your mind?
Well, I think one of the realities is, my understanding is, there's already 400 players who are actively showing up on a regular basis and working out at the team facility because they can, because they understand the benefit of doing it there, working out on their own. For a variety of reasons, they're allowed to do so. As of right now, the full gathering of the players doesn't happen until the week of May 24 anyway. That's what's so confusing about this. When I saw the NFL's full schedule for the offseason program, as it was proposed to the union, and the union said, no, thank you, I look at it and I say, well, what's the problem with it? See, this is the thing that gnaws at me, Peter, because the NFLPA doesn't have one cohesive explanation for why it's doing what it's doing. The surface level is the pandemic. Well, it's not the pandemic. You know, if you're concerned about the pandemic, number one, go get vaccinated. Number two, why do you have an issue with the league using... Yeah, but then beyond that, even if you don't get a vaccine, why all of a sudden do you have an issue with the exact same protocols that you agreed to last year for training camp, regular season, postseason? The same protocols apply when the players are there for the on-field workouts. Why do you hate those now? We've never gotten an answer to that, because I think the pandemic is being used as cover for, one, this is a middle finger to the NFL, for having the upper hand in the relationship, the rebellion against the 17-game season, and two, guys like J.C. Treader don't want any offseason program under any circumstance. Pandemic's a convenient thing to point to, but the pandemic isn't the reason why they're doing this. So it's creating this impression that you're not going to sell this unless you've got a rallying cry that everyone understands. The rallying cry collectively is not going to overcome the rallying cry in each of these guys' houses when they're getting tough questions from spouse, significant other, parent, agent, why the hell aren't you at work? What are they going to say? Why aren't you there? Well, they told me not to go. Well, why? Well, I don't know. They didn't want to go. But why? It's not going to hold together at that point, and that's when you're going to start seeing guys crossing a non-existent picket line.
Look, the last time that something like this happened, or anything like this happened really, is in 1987 when the way that when the NFL hired replacement players after 2 weeks of that season to play games, and they started actually playing games. They played 3 weeks with these replacement players. And the reason that the NFLPA solidarity died, you know, I remember Boomer Esiason, you know, basically laying down in front of a bus with the replacement players, you know, in Cincinnati. And the reason that that died is that guys like Lawrence Taylor crossed the picket line. And a lot of Randy White in Dallas, a lot of players started crossing the picket line. And once that happened, once named players decided to go and decided to go in, you know, everything crumbled. So my feeling is we'll see. They've got 11 teams now, and we'll see how solid they're going to be. But in my opinion, I agree, Mike, that the NFL last year saw that you can have a very good, very representative, enjoyable season, you know, that ended with some great drama and Tom Brady winning the Super Bowl and Brady versus Mahomes. It was fine. It was great. And the NFL has now seen that it can happen that way. And much to the chagrin of coaches, I really, really wonder, the coaches whose jobs are really on the line, how are they going to handle this? Like I'm serious. What if Matt Nagy cannot have Andy Dalton in for the entire length of the offseason? His job is on the line. Andy Dalton's job is on the line in the future as well. That's why I think this is going to be some interesting drama in the next few weeks.
And the coaches, and we've known this for 20 years, it rarely gets enforced, but most coaches are smart enough to avoid the line. They're not allowed to say or do anything to suggest that the voluntary workouts or anything. But, however, there's going to be no way to police whatever coaches say to the agents of specific players off the grid, talking to them, hey, I need your guy here. Look, we've known each other for a long time. We've done a lot of work together. We're going to continue to do a lot of work together. I value the relationship. I'm sure you do, too. I need your guy here. You got to get him here. And most of the agents are already wired to get their guys there. The guys who have workout bonuses, they're going to be there. The young guys who are trying to get one of those 53 jobs or one of the spots on the practice squad, they're going to be there because their agents are going to tell them to be there. And one last point in that regard, Peter. Well, 2 points. One, the NFLPA is not going to pressure four teams whose players have significant roster bonuses, Packers, Bills, Jaguars, Chiefs. That in and of itself creates an inherent division that will attract players from their competitors to show up because those teams are all working and getting ready. And secondly, we mentioned that 87 strike. I haven't researched this point of labor law, which is the subtle way that a lawyer says, I don't know the answer to the question. I haven't researched that quite yet. I don't know whether or not you can even have a picket line when you're talking about collective action that isn't a strike. It's not a strike. It's just guys exercising their prerogative under the CBA to not show up voluntarily. I wonder if they're going to have guys at or close to the edge of team facility property trying to keep guys out. I wonder if they're going to do that, and I wonder if they even can legally try. That's a wrinkle to this I hadn't considered. But if they're serious about it, they may have to do whatever they have to do to keep those guys from getting in. And if you got the veterans lined up out there and they're eyeballing you and they're telling you don't go across, that makes for some drama that I hadn't really anticipated.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's going to be an interesting story, because we don't know how it's going to play out over the next, let's say, month. And it's kind of interesting. The draft is going to be in the middle of it. So this is going to take a significant back seat, I believe, Mike, in terms of the news cycle and all that. Because, look, honestly, tell me why any fan should care about this. If I'm a fan, I don't care. I was thinking about this yesterday. What am I going to do in my column on Monday about this? And I mean, this is going to be one of these things that people are just going to glaze over and they don't care and they're not going to be passionate about it. So I really wonder, let's say in the next month, if indeed, as you say, that players could really get strong-armed into not showing up, you know, how big of an issue is it going to be from team to team to team? And I think, I really wonder, I don't think the public cares at all, number one. But number two, I wonder about things like team chemistry and how you're going to build whatever you're going to do this season in this off-season program. Coaches are going to figure a way, even if, you know, the NFLPA throws an incendiary device at the off-season programs around the league. Coaches will figure it out. But I do think that this is going to be a real uncomfortable time for a lot of teams and players.
And you say the fans don't care. I think part of what we do is make them care by drawing out the angles that are interesting and that show how things can collapse and how you can get yourself into a problem. And hey, if I'm a Bears fan and I know the Packers are going to be there because the union's not squeezing them to stay away and they're going to be getting better and they're going to be getting ready, if I'm a Bears fan, I'm not happy with that, because my team's already starting with a hand behind its back as the Packers are getting ready to, you know, build on what they've done the last two seasons. Let's take a break. Speaking of the Packers, Aaron Rodgers doing some good for the businesses in and around his hometown of Chico, California. We'll talk about that next here on PFT Live.
Thanks to Jeopardy, they're going to match your winnings and donate $25,100 to the North Valley Community Foundation, which is helping small businesses recover from the pandemic.
Aaron Rodgers working with the North Valley Community Foundation to create the Aaron Rodgers Small Business COVID-19 Fund. He kicked in $1 million. Other donations in excess of multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, and Jeopardy matching the winnings of all of the contestants during Rodgers' two-week stint as guest host. That ends tonight. Great news for the communities, a great look for Rodgers. There's an item in The Athletic from Matt Schneidman taking a close look at all the businesses that this effort has assisted. And it's something very positive that's coming out of this Rodgers two-week run as guest host, that Jeopardy is helping him create awareness, giving some money to it, and helping these businesses recover from what was a horrific experience for everyone when all of a sudden there's nobody walking through the door because of the pandemic.
The one thing that Aaron Rodgers has done, you know, love him, hate him, you know, however you feel about Aaron Rodgers, in my opinion anyway, the greatest trait that he has is that he has not forgotten where he came from. And I just really admire that about him, because I'm like everybody else. I've been watching Jeopardy. And I was thinking last night when he said that at the end of the show, I was thinking, okay, at the end of this period, that's going to be about $250,000. Because what? The average winner of Jeopardy maybe makes $25,000. So over a 10-show period, that's $250,000 that he has generated for, you know, the businesses, restaurant shops, whatever, in his home area in a desperate time for so many of them. So kudos to Aaron Rodgers.
He also mobilized when the fires a couple of years ago decimated that area. So they recover from the fires and then they have COVID, these businesses reeling, and Aaron Rodgers has done a great job of helping out his hometown. And he's done a great job on Jeopardy. I've enjoyed him. At first, I thought he was trying a little bit too hard to be like Alex Trebek, but then it kind of quickly settled in. I think he's done a fantastic job, and I wouldn't be surprised. I know he's not the favorite by any means, but I wouldn't be surprised if he finds a way to convince them to give him the job full-time, Peter.
Well, Mike, it was interesting. On Monday, in my column, I talked to Mike Richards, the executive producer, and another guest host during this period post-Trebek. And, you know, he was very, very high on Aaron Rodgers. He said he's going to have a great second career, that his second career might be better than his first, and all that. But in the wake of that, I got a call from a friend of mine, you know, who works in the TV business, not in sports. And this person said to me that, you know, you wrote, you know, that maybe he's not the favorite, maybe it's Ken Jennings, whatever. He goes, the reason why I think they're going to go with Aaron Rodgers, and he said, I have no inside information, is that it opens up a brand new, it opens up a brand new era for Jeopardy and a lot of new viewers, you know, who maybe say, hey, wow, Aaron Rodgers is the host. Let's watch this. And so I don't know what's going to happen, but it's very clear, Mike, they tape 5 shows in one day. And Aaron Rodgers said, I think to The Ringer, that so 46 days a year they tape. I can do that. And it really depends. Would this television property say, okay, we're going to tape all of our shows February, March, April. Let's just say somewhere around there, maybe go into May. But would they do that? And would maybe Aaron Rodgers work 4 days a week in Century City or wherever it is out in LA? And to me, I think it's possible. I really think it's possible. And because he wants it so bad, he's politicking for it. He wants it. And so, you know, we'll see what happens. But I think it's a good storyline, because in my opinion, if you're the NFL and you've seen all of these superstar players go into television, wouldn't you want one of your superstar players to go into a Brainiac television job? You know, instead of just going into a booth and doing games on TV. You know, to me, I think this would be great, not only for Rodgers, but I think it'd be really good for the NFL.
One quick point for me, and then we got to take a break. Usually there's a subtlety or a nuance that comes with pursuing a big job like this, because if you go at it too hard and you fail, you're a failure. But with football players, there is no nuance. They have never lived in nuance. When you play football, nuance gets you blown up from the blind side. You got to go get what you want, like Michael Strahan did when he wanted to replace Regis Philbin, and Aaron Rodgers is doing it now. He wants to replace Alex Trebek, and I will not be surprised if he does. Let's take a break. We're going to take a closer look at the dynamics at the top of the 2021 draft when PFT Live continues right after this.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn on what you want, like trying out that new workout class, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like a foam roller for your sore muscles. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.